Chapter 18. The law library was an archaic, underserved mess. Underserved because there was no real law librarian. The Northeast reporters were actually the books of Judge Prelate. He merely lent them to the Hickman County Law Library, kept them there. All Illinois judges received the reports by law as part of their budgets, for the legislature wanted judges immediately updated on all cases coming out of the courts of appeal and the Illinois Supreme Court. Judge Prelate was in that respect different from most other circuit court judges. He actually read the books, actually took them home with him and read the cases front to back before shelving them in the law library. Special Assistant Attorney General Rolanda Barr looked around her makeshift office in the Hickman County Law Library. What a dump, she thought. Compared to the vast law library she had enjoyed at the University of Illinois Law School, this was a sad joke. Compared to the computerized legal research on her laptop that gave her instant access to every law in the civilized world, every case decided in every Western country, this dump was totally unnecessary. They should bust up the bookcases for kindling and pass it out to the poor. Unnecessary. For that matter, so was Orbit. Farthest thing from her mind was coming to Podunk and prosecuting some floozy for killing her John. At least that's how she viewed the case at this point. All it represented to her was a minor irritant while she made ready her bid for the AG's job when her boss, Attorney General Robert Amastagio, ran for governor in 2016. She would be running for AG, and she was counting on her long history of wins of criminal prosecutions to so impress the electorate that it would be as if she were running unopposed. And come to think of it, another murder conviction under her belt could only help her win-loss record, on which voters put tons of weight. 63-0? Maybe this case could generate some publicity in this part of the state, and her name would be remembered for sending Victor Harrow's killer to the death chamber. Lethal injection of a local woman would make great headlines for surrounding counties, too, and her name would be right up there at the top of the story. Johnny Bladani was on his way to Orbit when he stopped off in South Chicago. Big Jim's Wholesale said the hand-painted sign on the rundown storefront where he roared the black caddy up to the curb. He checked his hair in the mirror, slicked his eyebrows down with saliva, and jumped out. He looked up and down the sidewalk and was satisfied he was alone and no one was following. If they were following, they were damn good. But he would lose them anyway, on the freeway. Who they were or why they might be following, he had no idea. He was born paranoid, and had learned that paranoid was the best mental state for staying out of prison. Or worse. It was the street warrior's best psychology. Screw what the pop psych books said about these or those feelings or emotions. He made his way inside Big Jim's, was immediately waved through the steel-grated door at the rear, and found Frankie Goodman Gunichi waiting for him by the work table. Frankie gave him a high five and waved his hand over the gun.
She's a beauty, no?
Laid out before him, still tightened down in the gun vise, where a final patina of Hope's gun oil was being lovingly worked into its action, was an AR-15, complete with scope and flash suppressor. The gun would be loud, so there would only be time for one shot, and Frankie warned him about that.
You lay rubber as soon as you pull the trigger, because this baby's gonna send the doves scattering and the cops running code 3. Wear these gloves. They don't leave fingerprints inside. Toss them from the window and leave them there. If you're within 100 yards, there's no need to adjust for windage. She fires a .223 caliber projectile, and she'll knock a man's hand off if you hit him in the finger. Every round hits, explodes, cuts, and slices and dices. Don't point it at nobody you don't mean to kill. That's $3,000.
Johnny withdrew Bang Bang's expenses roll and counted off 30 hundreds. He placed them on the table, and Frankie tenderly removed the weapon from its mount. He carefully slid it muzzle first inside the gun bag. Next came a 30-round clip.
All dum-dums and armor-piercing ammo, though you don't give a rat's ass about that. What's this guy do? He in a cop with a vest and nothing? Nobody, lawyer. Oh, huh. Then shoot him for me, too. Just kidding. One round and you're gone.
Thanks, Frankie. What do I do with the gun?
Drop it. Use the gloves. Drop it outside the car. You don't want to be pulled over with this baby in the back seat. She can't be traced. You've used the gloves. So no worry. Just drop her and tear ass.
Will do. Johnny headed back to the sidewalk where he again checked both directions. Satisfied, he laid the gun in the back seat and carefully edged away from the curb. No fancy driving now until the deed was done. The hit was worth $10,000. He was going to get his new wheels after all. He looked again at his palm, where he had carefully lettered the target's name, Thaddeus Murphy. She studied the facts on her desk. The SAAG was secretly happy and ready to flex some serious muscle around this sorry dump of a town. State workers would arrive at 7 a.m. and begin tearing out walls around the law library and installing new ones, installing paralegal cubicles and a new phone system hooked directly into the AG's main offices in Springfield and Chicago. They were going to ramp up for this. She had no doubt she would soon have at her disposal more square feet and more manpower than any other entity in the Hickman County Courthouse. They really wanted this one nailed, and they were going to spend taxpayer dollars to get the job done. She would have two paralegals, a junior associate, which meant one of the newer University of Chicago grads they loved to hustle on board, and at least two undercover AG investigators to run down all the leads in the case. There would be a stack of witness statements a foot high by the time those two finished their tenure in orbit. It was going to get hot and heavy. She only wondered if her opponent had any idea the drubbing he was in for. Thaddeus arrived at the law library office at exactly 2 p.m. SAAG Barr was sitting at the lone table in the law library. She looked tired and disgusted. Her hair was up, bun in back, but she was wearing an expensive silk suit with a small diamond necklace that fit perfectly to the hollow of her throat. There was no wedding band. There was no engagement rock. She was, and her deportment said, a woman of the world, alone and in the hunt. For the afternoon, the maintenance staff had scrounged up a lawyer chair, and she had positioned it on the far side of the table so that the table now served as her desk. Makeshift, but effective, Thaddeus thought, as he took a standard law library chair across from her. He noticed how close they were. He could have reached out and cold-cocked her. They were very close, compared to how a regular desk keeps a safe distance between two people. For a moment, he felt empowered. He was the male, she was the female. By any law of any jungle, he should win here. He decided against the crazy inspiration to just hit her. That would only wind him up in a cell down from Ermeline. He chased the thought from his mind like some magic rabbit that wanted to lead him down the crazy hole. No, he had to play this just right, make his position known, and start convincing the SAAG that his client was innocent and that somehow things had come to look horribly bad for her. "I want to begin by saying," he announced in his strongest voice, but she abruptly cut him off. "Here," she said, and tossed an inch of documents at him. "Here's your discovery. The dead guy photos are there, but they're all copies. I can get you glossies if you've got the stomach for it. Some lawyers don't want the real close-ups. You're probably one of those." She smiled as she made the comment about his stomach for all this. "That said," she held up a hand to counter his reply, "let me finish, please. I am only going to say this one time, Mr. Murphy. Thaddeus, or Thad is fine. I prefer Mr. Murphy. Keeps it official. I'm only going to say this one time, and I'm only going to make this offer one time. I will allow your client to plead guilty in return for her serving a full life sentence. No possibility of parole or early release. I put an AG's rush on the gun and knife, and your client's booking prints are a 100% certain match to what they've found on the barrel and the knife handle. She held the weapons, pulled the trigger, cut the letters of her name. This offer must be accepted by 9 a.m, or it is forever withdrawn. If it is withdrawn, I will personally be in the witness room when your client receives the lethal injection. So far in my practice, I have watched 8 dirtbags get the needle. I put every last one of them on that table, and I'm about to do the same to Ermeline Ransom. Any questions?"
I agree. You need to discuss this plea offer with your client. You should do that now. The deal is only good until 9 a.m. At 9 a.m. in the morning, we both go to the judge's chambers and tell him we have a plea. He accepts the plea in open court on the spot. If that isn't underway by 9:01 in the morning, there will be no deal. You will have to put the needle in your client's arm yourself. You may leave now."
The next thing he knew, when he fully regained his sense of conscious thought, he had climbed downstairs, out the courthouse doors, and down the stairs again, and was now headed toward the jail. He was on autopilot, and he had no choice but to go directly to the jail and tell Ermeline what had just happened. There would be no sugarcoating, no holding out false hope. She would then be left with a decision: go to trial and risk making her son an orphan, or plead guilty and try to see him once a month until he got old enough and embarrassed enough that he no longer cared. Thaddeus felt as if he might throw up, and would have, if he hadn't known she was even now standing at the law library window watching him struggle to the jail, a huge smile on her face. She had put the fear in him, turned him into a believer, and he didn't have the slightest idea what came next.
Within minutes, he was in the jail, said hello to no one, and found himself in Ermeline's cell as the jailer shut the door on his way out. He was in shock, and he knew it. He thumbed the stack of discovery documents the SAAG had just thrown across the desk at him. Ermeline gave him a puzzled look. She had had lunch and was dozing lightly when he came in. He looked at her and shook his head. "It's not good." He went on to tell her all about what had just happened, and he dissected it for her, what the elements of first-degree murder were: willfulness, premeditation, and intent. The state could prove, he explained to her, that she had willfully confronted Victor at his bus, that she had planned out the confrontation because she had obtained a gun and knife and taken them with her. The state could prove that there was intent to commit murder, because it could be inferred from the fact of Victor's death. There was willfulness all over the place, he said, and there was intent not only from the fact of the death, but also because she had the motive. She had sued Victor for cutting her up. What about manslaughter? She wanted to know. The jailer had said she might get a plea to manslaughter. Was that possible? He explained how manslaughter applied to heat-of-the-moment killings, a sudden flare-up, a mental state that no one could have seen coming due to the immediate nature of the act, which prompted the violence. She had taken a gun with her. There was no sudden flare-up, no heat of the moment. He explained the fingerprints and how they were lifted from the gun and compared to her booking prints, how the computers analyzed, matched, and analyzed some more, and how the computers were never wrong. Tears came to her eyes.
I don't feel like you are on my side anymore, she said, and wept.
He could stand it no longer. He stood up from the bunk and sat down beside her. He put his arm across her shoulders and gave her a hug.
I'm sorry, he whispered.
She leaned into him and put her head on his shoulder. For several minutes they sat this way, nobody moving, barely breathing. Finally, he relaxed his grip and stood. He took two steps and sat back down on his side of the cell. Now, he said simply, and he suddenly knew what came next. Now we have to figure out how to kick some ass. Her head popped up.
Kick some ass? That's the best thing I've heard since I got here.
He stood and began pacing. Ermeline, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but you're not going down. This is not going to happen to you. We're going to find a spot, a weakness, and we're going to attack. We're going to find some chink in their armor, and we're going to kick some ass. She stood up then and threw her arms around him.
Save me, Thad, she pleaded. Just let me go home to my little boy.
You have my word. You're walking out of this a free woman.